Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, August 12th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever been introduced to. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. It's a tool I've used to great effect over the past 17-plus years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships. It's also a tool I've been able to use to turn any negative emotional state into part of the infallible guidance system that each of us have been gifted. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click it, download it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even young audiences. You can also download a host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process or talked about how positively the actual use of that tool has been in affecting their lives. You can also download a 24.5-minute PowerPoint presentation created by Bill Costantino, which will take you deeper into the workings of that tool and how it works and why it works as well as it does. And we hope people do that soon and often because that usually promotes questions, comments, answers, testimonials, and you can share those with us at 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little question by your phone number, and I'll see that and announce you by your area code. Alternatively, you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org, and or you can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, and we'll be happy to address your comments or questions on the show. And if you can't listen live, you can listen through the archives. It's another wonderful free resource available at whyagain.org. Today's Thursday, and so we will have a support group, 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central, and the information about that is at mindshiftersacademy.org. We're also doing the Course in Miracles lessons this year, so today is the 224th day of the year, and today's lesson is God is my Father, and He loves His Son. The Creator is my Source, and creation loves its offspring. My true identity is so secure, so lofty, sinless, glorious, and great, holy, beneficent, and free from guilt, It is so much so that heaven looks to it to give it light. That's my true nature. Heaven looks to my true nature to give it light. My true nature lights the world as well. It is the gift of creation to me, the one that I give to the world. There is no gift but this that can be either given or received. The gift of creation is all there is. This is reality and only this. This is illusion's end. This is the truth. And then they offer, my name, O Father, is known to you. I have forgotten it and do not know where I am going, who I am, or what it is I do. Remind me, Creator, now, for I am weary of the world I see. Reveal what you would have me see instead. And then the Pam Grout Course in Miracles experiment book says, chapter 224 is titled, A Case of Mistaken Identity. She quotes Dave Mason as saying, I can't just sit here vibrating with my own joy. I have to write about it. I have to share it. Pam Grout writes, a tribe I visited in Namibia gathers for a special ritual when a mom-to-be is 7 months pregnant. They dance, they sing, and most importantly, they consciously ask about the to-be-born baby and what his or her purpose is for this human lifetime. Each tribe member then takes a vow to honor it. They genuinely want to know and support each of their brothers and sisters' highest spiritual purpose. Imagine how different our lives would be if we'd been asked about our true identity, asked about our spiritual purpose before we were born. In lesson 224, and she restates it as, my true identity is so glorious that heaven looks to me for light. This lesson instructs me to abandon the cookie-cutter lifestyle. And so I enlist the Holy Spirit to reveal what you would have me do instead. So that is our Course in Miracles workbook lesson for today and the Pam Grout Course in Miracles experiment commentary. And we have about 50 minutes left to entertain questions, comments, answers, soliloquies, suggested topics. I think I already mentioned today's a Thursday, so that means we have a support group tonight. And we'd be happy to have you join us. It's absolutely free. It runs from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. I should say, God willing, and the Internet stays up, because we got our Tuesday group cut quite a bit short because of power failures, et cetera. And it's free to join, and the information for joining us is available at mindshiftersacademy.org. On that website, there's a separate page for the Tuesday and Thursday support group info. So feel free to join us or pass that information along to somebody you think might benefit from joining us. And in the meantime, we have time to talk. One of the things I was reading earlier this morning was Anthony DeMello in the book Awareness. And one of my favorite little quips from that book is he says, we cannot be like our guru. We cannot be like Jesus by imitating our guru's behavior or our spiritual teacher's behavior. A while back there were these bracelets, WWJD, that stood for What Would Jesus Do? And think about what Jesus would do and then just mimic that. And the point that Anthony DeMello was making all those years ago when he was giving his seminars was, you cannot be like Jesus by mimicking his behavior. You have to be what he was internally. You have to understand the whole process. Michael Rice likes to talk about idiom, the phrase from the ancient Aramaic that said, eat my body and drink my blood. And all that meant was, it didn't mean some, you know, barbaric ritual of cannibalism. It simply meant, learn everything I've learned. Learn to question everything I've questioned. Learn to think about things as deeply as I've thought about them. Learn to observe and question and ask to be taught the way I'm learning and questioning and asking to be taught. And Anthony DeMello says, if a monkey sees a person blowing into a flute and playing the flute, sees a musician playing a flute, and the musician puts the flute down and the monkey comes over and mimics it and blows into the flute, that doesn't make the monkey a musician. You can mimic your guru, and that does not make you enlightened or a guru. He tells the story of the guru who had a follower, and the follower said he was going off to live in isolation, to pray and meditate and study and learn about enlightenment. And when he left, every month he would send the guru another letter, another note. And the first note came back, I've found the true meaning of silence, and the guru just ripped it up. And then the next month he got a note that said, I'm learning the experience of oneness with all creation, and the guru just ripped it up and threw it away. Month after month, these, you know, I've had a glimpse of enlightenment, and then the guru ripped it up and threw it away. And after a while, you know, years into this, the notes quit coming. And so the guru said, and he had a friend who was going to be traveling that way, he said, hey, when you go over in that, you know, in that direction, ask about this guy. Find out if you know what happened to this guy. And so he went out and he asked about him. And not too long after that, the guru received a note from his disciple that said, what does it matter? And the guru said, he's enlightened. Right? So it's not about parroting words. It's not about doing more worksheets than somebody else. It's not about learning the perfect way to do EFT tapping. It's about changing the internal experience that each of us is creating, most often without even knowing that we're creating it. Most often, most of us have been conditioned to believe, trained to believe, brainwashed to believe that the world is creating our experience of it and that we are just victims. So I've said this before, even though we've got lots and lots of time that we spend talking and we've got lots and lots of recordings of people saying words about this process or that process or this experience or that experience, the point of this work is not the words. The point of this work is not the talk. The point of this work is the experience. I had the pleasure this morning of interviewing Steve Michio, and Steve has become a leader in the peer-led mental health world. And the core thing that gives him so much value is that he has lived the experience of having a mental health crisis and being labeled as bipolar and being hospitalized and force-fed medications. It's the lived experience that is enlightenment. It's in the moment awareness that is enlightenment. It's not words about those things. So all of these words, all of these experiences we're sharing are like the finger pointing toward the moon. They are not the moon. I can't decide I'm going to become aware or be enlightened if I just do enough worksheets and then just engage in a rote process of filling out worksheets without asking to be shown in each worksheet, without canceling, literally working at figuring out what does it mean for me to cancel my goal, my need to be right, so that I usher myself into a different experience, that I let go of the vice-like grip I have on my sense of self or my identity or my need to feel important or my need to have people view me in a certain way. It's only in the process of changing my relationship with those ideas and beliefs and cravings that I get ushered into a different experience. And that's what this work is about for us, is giving people the tools that they can use to usher themselves into a different experience of life. And it takes willingness, it takes application of the tools, it takes the willingness to address one's own fears. I mean, there's so many of us say that we want change and we work and we do these things to want change. So at some level we do want some change, or we wouldn't read these books or listen to these podcasts or fill out these worksheets. And yet the actual level of our willingness has yet to be revealed. We talk about being willing far more than we actually are, because we don't even know what that experience of deep willingness looks like. And for many of us, we will have a whole set of beliefs about what it looks like and what it should feel like. And when we start to do something and it doesn't feel the way we think it should, then we back away from it. Well, you cannot know what enlightenment feels like. You can't go out in search of enlightenment and find enlightenment. I'll say that again. You can't go out in search of enlightenment and find enlightenment. And the reason for that is because when you go out searching for something, you've got some idea of what it is. And the truth about what enlightenment is beyond anything you've ever experienced or your conscious logical mind can know. You can't know what you don't know. Guy Finley likes to say, the new, those things that are truly new, cannot be known. They can only be experienced and only experienced once. I have tried to turn on the microphone for Susan Bingham. Susan, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, welcome.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, you're talking around, all around, one of the reasons that I haven't even been on the radio show that much lately. It's as if everything went quiet, and that doesn't mean dark, but I felt as if I just had to stop everything and wait. And there was a lot of family stuff going on, many, many interruptions. It was too crazy to even get on the phone to say anything, and I had to get on and off and on and off because driving people places, we've had a family reunion, endless stuff. But I reached a point where it was hard to listen. It was hard to do my worksheets. It wasn't that I was trying to figure anything out. It's as if I stopped trying to figure anything out and just waited. And I love today's lesson because it acknowledges, I forget the words. What were the words of today's lesson? I am weary of the world I see. Reveal what you would have me see. I feel as if I love that because it's an acknowledgement of not knowing and maybe some hopelessness, some depression, all kinds of things. but then it's an opening to reveal what you would have me see. So I apologize. I mean, I feel as if I've been an unreliable co-host, even though you never set it up in a formal way, and you've been great, and you always have great shows anyway, and you read wonderful stuff, and it's wonderful to just listen when I can, and all the new material that's coming in. So there's that. And we had a family reunion that was one of the most inspiring and beautiful and loving reunions we've ever had. It's as if my son's cousins, there are several cousins in that, you know, in the age of kind of 35 to 55, and then lots of aunts and uncles. And we had 22 people at our family retreat, and out of about 35 possible attendees. And the discussions were, I felt as if I was, this is what heaven must be like, except you wouldn't need to discuss these things because you'd be in heaven. And they were basically people talking about where they are in their lives, what they've learned, but all of it within a tremendous amount of appreciation from one another and love for one another. And one of the people there was my son, who is one of the reasons I just went down for the count. I was just watching him go through what one of his most wonderful cousins said is, you are both going through a midlife crisis and you're in a field that is just struggling, and you've always had your own issues with anxiety and depression, and this is like a threefold
whammy
challenge. Whammy, yeah. And he said, just hang in there, we're with you, you're so wonderful, you know it was just such tremendous support given, and without judgment or no suggestions. Except one cousin said, you know what I've been doing? And it's like drops of water on a rock. Insignificant, perhaps. But I start with the letter A in the alphabet, and I letter A, well, today I'm grateful for apples, and B, baseball bats, C, my cats. He would go as far into the alphabet as time would allow. And he said, It's like a little nothing exercise, but gradually it turns the ship around, and the ship feels so big, the ship of discouragement and going in the wrong direction, not knowing. He said, I have been practicing this along with other practices, and it's been good to do, and I suggest you do it. And my son said, I will do it, and I think he is doing it. So it's as if we all are kind of coming up with tools as we do our work. And Michael's tools got me this far, and now I feel as if, whoa, we've hit pay dirt in the way of issues, challenges. I realized today, for instance, that, I know I'm rambling, but I'm almost finished. My life purpose has gone off from whatever it might have been to fixing my kids, fixing my son, helping my son, being there for my son in a way that will heal him. All of that has to go. Just holding the presence and remaining centered and well and finding my own purpose again. I haven't done it. I don't even know what it is. I've lost such sight of it. But anyway, that's my report for the moment. Signing out.
Okay. Well, and you know, I just had a session with somebody who was reviewing her life and thinking about what a failure she is, and we just had the session, and I said, I have to let you know that you're absolutely wrong.
Oh yeah.
Like it's possible to spin the filter and look at it as though she's a failure, but to do that, she has to ignore, you know, 99.99% of her life. And if she looks at her life and assesses it in terms of what her high school people signed in her, you know, her yearbook that she would be this or that, or comparing herself to somebody else, or comparing herself to some dream she had that said because she has these skills she should have her own business or do. If she compares her life to that, of course she can come up with a way in which it looks like she's a failure. But that's not all there is to her life. It's not even close to the only way to look at it. And there are dozens of ways to look at it as her being successful. And of course, you know, I'm reminded of the It's a Wonderful Life story and the whole idea of how many people we affect positively without ever even knowing it. You know, the impact we have on people, either as an example of how not to live your life or an example of how to live your life, the little kindnesses we do that have ripple effects that end up being tremendous influences in our world, we don't know any of that. And so when we stop and try to make a conscious, logical judgment about the value of our lives or lack of value in our lives, it's just an intellectual game. It has no value other than the feeling it produces in us.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we don't like the feeling that we're producing when we create this belief or that belief about our life value, choose again. Create a different belief about your life value. Remember that book that you introduced us to, the Jesus, My Autobiography book?
Yeah.
Do you remember that book? That book is one of the ones that says so directly, so beautifully, and simply that your internal guidance system is your emotions. And if your emotions are pleasant, you're probably headed in the right direction spiritually and in your life purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And if your emotions are not pleasant, you're probably not headed in the right direction.
Yeah.
So if you create an assessment of your life that leaves you feeling bad about your life, choose again. It's probably not accurate. It's certainly not complete.
I'm not feeling badly about my life. I'm not even really, I don't feel like a success or a failure. In fact, I've had a lifetime of amazing successes, and I don't feel that way. What I'm feeling is right now, my purpose has been misguided. It is to, in some ways it's been guided, to be there for my children. Yeah, that's a wonderful purpose. But to think I have to fix them and to suffer if they're not well is not part of that purpose. I'm not really thinking about success or not, or I don't even mean to think about shoulds or not, or maybe I am and it's buried and I'm not even conscious of it, but
and so are you waking up to realize that it's not productive to see yourself as responsible for your offspring's happiness?
Well, when you put it that way, yes, that would be a productive thought, that it would be best not to feel responsible. That's good. That brings it into focus. I have been feeling responsible. But I'm saying, even if I didn't feel responsible, I am sitting here being a witness, not only to my son, who's doing pretty well, you know, he, in his own way, and I've got three grandsons who aren't in such great shape right now, 3 out of 5 who are struggling, and I am a witness, and I guess I could choose type. It's not a great feeling to be witnessing this, and maybe that's what you're talking about, is the feeling is the clue. There's something not right here. But how could I be joyful in the face of witnessing some serious suffering? I don't know. I don't know whether that should be a goal or anything. And
don't
I don't
know
even know if I'm
making goal.
Sense.
You don't know if what should be a goal.
To feel joy in my life while this is happening.
Oh, yeah, well, it's not about it. It should be a goal, but the question to ask is, can it be? Can I find a way? And maybe you can, maybe you can't. But in the questioning, we open up to realize that none of that is written in stone. And then we open ourselves up to realize that it's the way we've chosen to interpret and respond to it that's actually creating our emotion about it. It isn't the truth of this person. It isn't the truth of their health or their mental health or their illness. It's my judgment about it that's creating my emotions.
Good. Yes. I know you've said that a million ways, and it's good to hear it again. Yes.
Well, you know, there's a, you know, the woman I had in my office, and she's got all these things that she knows. She was plenty smart enough to go to a four-year college, and she's creative enough that she could have had her own business, and she looks at her life and says she didn't do any of that, and so she's a failure. And I said, you're wrong. And one of the ways you're wrong is you've got these three kids that you raised, and you know, you've set really strong, healthy boundaries around abusive patterns from your family of origin and your first husband who was so abusive, and you had the strength to get out of that. I just kept ticking off these things that are also true.
Yeah.
That are not included in her assessment when she focuses on, but I always wanted to go to college and I never did. I always wanted to start my own business and I never did. Okay.
Whoa,
but that is not all there is to life. And when you put that filter on and judge yourself based on that, it's just a mental game. And when you go to play a mental game, if it doesn't feel good mentally and emotionally, choose again. That's what we're offering. So you can look at your, you know, your family right now. You can take this snapshot and say, oh, my gosh, three of my five grandsons are struggling. And woe is us and woe is me. And okay, but remember, it's just a snapshot. And you're throwing some pretty heavy judgments on it, and you're creating a certain emotional experience. How do you like that emotional experience? Is there more to these grandsons than just the struggles they're having? Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, you talked some time back about the difference between awareness, observation, and judgment. And I think that's just the line that needs to be drawn. I can see what they're doing as best I can, observe, be aware, but not judge. And I have a question in that. When I see a person doing something harmful, I immediately not only observe, but judge. As something as good or bad, right or wrong, or and in worse ways,
as your training has taught you to.
Yeah, that's true. But do you think it's possible? I guess it must be, to just be able to observe and be aware without any judgment.
Not in the beginning, no, because humans have been trained to do that judgment thing. However, it's possible to get more awake and aware of the judgment earlier and earlier and release it.
Oh, okay.
And then see the negative impact of buying into it and acting from it, and then choosing differently.
Yeah,
right? So,
that's,
you know,
good.
let's say that I was raised in Mexico, and I was raised to think that, you know, white-skinned people are, you know, mean and they're stupid and they're whatever. And that's what I was raised as. And then you know, at some point or another, I see somebody driving a car, and they happen to be not driving a car. I see somebody, and they're in a car that's, you know, like in an accident over on the side of the road. And I instantly see the white skin and say, "Oh, that person probably caused this."
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's just gonna happen. You know, those white-skinned people don't never know how to drive, and they're always creating suffering in the world. And so it's going to happen. That thought's going to come into my mind. It's also possible for me to become aware of that thought as part of the automatic conditioning and chuckle at it and say, oh, look, that's happening. And, that's silly because that I don't know anything about how that person got in that accident and who caused it. So that's our job. Our job is not to dismantle all judgment. Our job is to become aware of the judgment and aware of what happens when we buy into the judgment, we take it as truth, and we let it inform our actions.
That's good. So the conscious logical mind is useful for many things. Yeah.
Yes, and it does what it's been trained to do quite reliably. So it's been trained to judge. And the observing mind can learn, and we can choose to spend more of our mind energy in the observer position.
Mm-hmm.
And as we do that, we soften the grip of that process of buying into the conscious logical mind and its all of its judgments. We don't end it. Go ahead.
In the Course in Miracles, it says that if we are depressed or we don't feel well, we have been attacking. We have attacked. I don't know which lesson that was, but that makes total sense. So this is a way to feeling better if we step back and observe and withdraw the judgments. We may find ourselves feeling better. Yeah.
Probably.
So.
There's another lesson I've quoted a few times recently that says, we need only return to the original error in thought in order for all of the negative effects of that thought to be dismantled.
Mm-hmm.
So I have the judgment. It's an automatic process. If I have enough of my mind energy focused on my observer self, I step back and I say, oh, look at that. I'm judging that this person must have done something wrong, and that's why they're in that situation. And I can observe how that thought and the energy that comes up in it is so tense and negative, and how that feels in me if it starts to formulate an emotion. And I can just take a breath and step back and observe it, and as soon as I do, it loses its power over me. It's like being aware of a 5-mile-an-hour wind that's a headwind when I'm trying to, you know, walk or ride my bike or drive my car to a certain destination. I can become aware of the wind and not have it push me in the wrong direction. Well, awareness has that kind of liberating ability or power related to all of my thoughts and emotions.
Nice. So, I have another thing I wanted to ask you, but I wanted to make sure nobody else was on, wanting to come on.
Okay, the runway's clear. You're clear for landing. What do you got?
I did this 9-day novena to St. Jude. I had told you about it, and I finished it. Would it be okay if I read it to you? Because I have questions embedded here and there. Have you ever read a novena prayer?
How long is it?
It's not. It's a few paragraphs.
Okay, go ahead.
It is too long. Okay. Novena to St. Jude, Desperate Situations and Hopeless Cases. Now, that's the mindset set up right there. Okay. Most Holy Apostle St. Jude, faithful servant and friend of Jesus, the church honors and invokes you universally as the patron of difficult cases, of things most despaired of. Pray for, and in my case it was Jonathan. Intercede with God for me. Jude is like an interceder, like the way Mary is. Intercede with God for me that he bring visible and speedy help, where help is almost despaired of. Come to Jonathan's assistance in his great need, that he may receive the consolation and help of heaven in all his necessities, tribulations, and sufferings, particularly, and then you fill in, and I filled in, for his anxiety, depression, faulty thinking, and bursts of anger against his son, that he may praise God with you and all the saints forever. I promise, O blessed St. Jude, this is where I get into a little trouble. I promise, O blessed St. Jude, to be ever mindful of this great favor granted Jonathan by God, and to always honor you as my special and powerful patron, and to gratefully encourage devotion to you. So there's a little deal made in there that if the prayer is granted, you will speak on behalf of
you'll
St.
do the
Jude.
Impossible. You'll listen.
Right.
You'll do the impossible. I don't know where you got this, but what strikes me is you're setting yourself up to lie and to fail.
I know. Right there. Okay. Say more. What struck you?
Well,
come on.
Yeah. You're a human being living a life.
Yeah.
You've got kids. You've got grandkids. You've got kids that aren't kids anymore. You've got, you know, radio show stuff. You've got friends that you're trying to connect with and friends that you're trying to hold boundaries with, and you've got finances, and you've got your sexuality, and you've got the politics and the coronavirus and the – how can you live up to that, always keeping this focus on this saint? It's not possible.
Wow, I didn't take it that far, Dr. Tim. I just thought that when
well,
it crossed the mind,
I just
mind,
look
I
at what
there.
You read. Look at what you read. Please read the last couple sentences again. I promise to do what?
I promise, O blessed St. Jude, to be ever mindful of this great favor granted Jonathan by God, as if it's already done.
Ever mindful. I will never forget this. You will always be in my thoughts. I will always be indebted to you.
Well, I did. I felt like a fraud because I thought, well, you know, I will tell people that I prayed to St. Jude, but am I going to live up to this? Anyway, I got a little nervous about that part, but I went through the whole 9 days. I'm not done yet. You want to hear the rest?
Well, I don't know. Do you understand what I just said about how it sounds like you're making a promise that you can't possibly keep? Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And it goes on. So maybe I don't need to go on. I mean, basically, it goes on to say, may the most sacred heart of Jesus be adored and loved in all the tabernacles until the end of time. And I thought, well, I wouldn't pray for that. I mean, I would pray for love to prevail. And so I sort of adjusted that part of it. May the most sacred heart of Jesus be praised and glorified now and forever. Well, I made a little adjustment there that the love of God be praised. And St. Jude, pray for us and hear our prayers. Amen. And then you say, blessed be St. Jude Fabius in all the world and for all eternity. And I'm thinking, yeah, that sounds good, but I'm not going to be the ones doing all this. And anyway, so there, you got the sense of it. I got a feeling as if I was selling my soul to, you know, doing some kind of proselytizing for St. Jude. It was like a making a deal that if Jonathan got some relief.
Okay, but that is what that is. I mean, what you're reading is a prayer that comes from a transactional religious belief system.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, it's
well,
all, I mean, they had indulgences and they had, you know, they had all kinds of mortal sins, venial sins, you know, time in purgatory, time worked off with indulgences, indulgences that you could buy with good deeds, indulgences you could buy with donations to your church. I mean, it's a transactional system. And you're reading a prayer from that zero-sum transactional system, of course it's going to feel like a deal because that's what you're doing.
Okay. All right. Thanks for letting me take you through that one.
And the thing that comes to me there is to say, you know what, there isn't necessarily anything wrong with any of that, except mm-hmm. that the trap for you is, once again, that you're taking it so literally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so if you soften it up and you don't take it so literally, then, okay, some pleasant thoughts. And I encourage you to do what you did. You reword it so it makes sense to you. Because,
yeah.
you know, what somebody has in their mind as you as the saint and you as Jesus and the body of Christ and all of that, well, it might make more sense to you because of your personal and spiritual work to say, I'm going to commit to spreading love, and I'm going to commit to hoping that love is in everyone's hearts, not necessarily this saint in that tabernacle, et cetera. So do that. This is your mind energy that you're directing to try and create something positive in your life, and it's fine
right.
the way you want to do it. It doesn't matter how many different religious people out there would say, oh, you're not doing it right. It may not be right for them, and it might be wonderful for you.
Yeah. Well, I did approach it that way, and I did. It was a peaceful thing. I liked doing it. But, of course, I had this thing of my son would call me coming home from work, and I'd say, how was it? And he'd say, it was utter chaos. They added four emergency operations onto the four I already had. So I ended up doing 8 procedures during the day, and we were just scrambling. And every day is like that. So he'd call, and then I'd say, well, how did you feel in the morning? Mornings are the worst. He said, I always feel as if I just cannot do it. I cannot put one foot in front of the other. My stomach's upset. I sit on the pot. I have diarrhea every single day. And then by noon, it's beginning to lift, and I'm beginning to think I can live every day. So for me to really apply the tools and live and be well with this is like the challenge of my life, to allow this, to accept it. I mean, I can't allow it. It's already doing, but to...
Well, the allowance is you noticing your resistance and then dropping it rather than pouring more energy into it.
Okay.
So, you know, the idea of allowance, the way Way of Mastery talks about it and some of the Course in Miracles stuff, is, you know, people say, well, I don't have any choice. I mean, it's raining. Yeah, but you can still practice allowance. You can say, mm-hmm. I allow it to rain. Well, what difference does it make? Well, what it does is it activates my awareness of how I'm resisting the rain and letting me drop the resistance. That's what the practice of allowance is.
Oh, boy.
Right, because it is going to rain. And if I'm driving and mm-hmm. it's raining and I'm going, guys, that's not what was predicted for today and this darn rain, and then I'm not allowing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? That means I'm resisting. I'm pouring energy into resistance. So the allowance, the way it's taught in this work, is the recognition of resistance and the release of it. So I'm going to choose to pour less energy into the resistance. I'm going to catch it and let it go. So it's a very useful practice, even though your literal mind says, well, there's nothing to allowing it because it's already happening.
Yeah, I get it. And I didn't ever, the resistance word, I hadn't thought of that way, Dr. Tim. That's very helpful. Okay. Whenever you're upset, you're wrong. You're in error. Whenever you're upset, you're wrong. You're in error. You're resisting.
Yes. You're creating the pain, the tension, the anger, the fear, the sadness through your resistance.
Okay.
And that even goes for physical, you know, broken bones and bruises and things. I'm not creating the pain of the broken bone. But when I resist it, when I say, this shouldn't have happened, and doggone it, and why can't they get to the hospital in time, or where's my pain meds, or all of that is adding suffering to the physical discomfort.
Yeah.
And it isn't needed. And those people who have learned to practice that allowance, which basically means catching and then releasing the resistance, they have felt the difference. They've experienced the difference. And that, you know, back to the intro, that's what this is about. This is about helping people have a different experience. So people don't really understand what allowance is until they practice catching and releasing their resistance, and then they start to have an actual experience that they're creating very differently than what they were doing minutes before or for years before.
Yeah.
So did you hear me talk about the 1 Million Lives Project and the check-in that's available for you the other day? For you, for your son, for your grandsons, et cetera, you can just go to this website, oml.world.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
And take a free check-in. And pardon me?
I took it. I did it this morning on my iPhone, which is the bad way to do it because it's so small. I had a lot of questions about that, probably too many for the show. I compared it to the, you know, my score, my ending after many, oh, not many, I took the personal code evaluation a couple of times. The final time that I took it, I, according to Michael and Jeannie, I did extremely well. Now, I still have areas of challenge. With this one, I had some serious questions. First of all, my mental health level is fair, and I was answering questions honestly and thinking to myself, well, I'm answering honestly. This shows that I'm really mentally healthy. Yeah. And they had, what was one question? How much do you use social media? 1 to 2 hours a day? Well, I put 1 to 2 hours a day because I use it, but I don't use it an hour a day, and it was not the truth, but zero wasn't the truth either, so I think they need a little more detail in there, like...
Well, but listen, again, you're trying to be really literal and read more into it than there. If you got anything other than fair mental health, I would say that was inaccurate. If you got something better than that, I'd say that's inaccurate. Why? Because you, look at what you just said in the beginning of this radio show. Look at all that's going on in your life right now. You're stressed. This isn't an intelligence test. This isn't a good or bad value test. This is a check-in for you. If this didn't show that there's some stress going on in your life, then it wouldn't be at all an accurate tool. It would be completely useless to you.
You've lost me. I don't understand what you just said, Dr. Tim. You mean...
Good. There you go. That means it's right at the heart. So take a breath.
Okay.
And this is a good adjustment for you for the personal code evaluation as well. there's a way in which, and I'm not sure the details and how much, but there's a way in which you're using this as a judgment of you, and it's not.
Yeah, I get that.
So put down the judgment piece. Recognize it and release it. Take a nice, deep, calming breath or two. If you took an assessment like the mental health check-in right now with all that you just talked about has been going on in your life, and it said that your mental health right now is anything more than fair, I'd say it's inaccurate. There's always stuff we can do a little bit better. There's times where we're more high stress than others. But listen to what you just said about your son. Listen to the report that 3 out of 5 of your grandsons are swimming in challenges. Of course you're going to be stressed. Listen to what you said earlier in the radio show about how you still feel like it's your responsibility to suffer if they're suffering or to find a way to help them end their suffering before you feel happy again.
Thor was right.
Probably. Why? Okay. Because you answered it. You provided the answers that go into this assessment. And it's not about value. It's not about you're good, you're doing this good, you're doing that bad, you're smart, you're not good person. It's got nothing to do with any of that. It's a way to look at these various areas of your life which might be stressing you or providing you relief from stress and assessing them more accurately. That's all that's about.
And then they give these little links to suggestions, and I think that's great. I haven't done any of them because it was early in the morning and I had to get going, but I love the idea of the whole thing. I am going to send it to a friend of mine who has a daughter who's having some problems, and she might be able to do it. She might not have the focus, but anyway, I'm getting off on a tangent. But yeah, it's a very interesting thing. I'm glad you gave it. I heard it on the, I was driving home from an airport, dropped off a daughter, so I couldn't talk, but I wrote down that moml.world link. Yeah. Interesting.
All right. Okay, well, keep up the great work. You're fabulous. You're excellent. You're the best person that's ever been, and you're getting better every day.
Now you're just making fun of me, and I could use that against the whole thing and go right down the tubes, but I won't.
I'm not trying to make fun of you. I'm trying to help you see you are succeeding in ways that you are not looking at. And if you shift the filter to that, then at least in that moment, you're not creating all the negativity.
Yeah. I feel as if I'm on a bucking bronco and I'm holding on. That's what it feels
like.
Yeah,
but you are holding on. So it's that's a success at so many in so many ways.
Great.
So try to look
it
on the bright side, right? And try to look at all the ways that you're a success.
Okay, thanks.
Do that exercise that one of your family members suggested for your son. Go through the alphabet and just say, I'm grateful for this, 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 and this.
I'm doing it. Believe me, I am. And it's good.
Okay.
And it's funny.
And a modification of that can be, you know, go and find a positive descriptor of yourself that starts with each of the letters of the alphabet.
Holy mackerel, Dr. Tim. Okay.
Yeah, I know. Every once in a while I say something that's really good.
That's very good. You should put that in the notes. All right. Thank you, thank you, thank you, as always.
Well,
T for
welcome,
Tim Hayes.
You're very
welcome.
You're very welcome. I will mute you so we can make the transition. I look forward to our next contact. Blessings. And I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Right before this show, Jeannie texted me and said they are caught up in something, and so we're doing a replay. So enjoy this replay of the Why Again First Hour Workshop. Thanks, everyone.
What exists is energy in form. And relative to this integrated energy system that we call a body-mind unit, there are two qualities. There's integrative energy, that which is over on the left side of the board, and disintegrative energy, that which is over here on the right side of the board. Now, we've had the experience over the last 2 years. Our granddaughter came into the world just a little over 2 years ago. And, you know, it was this little baby, little structure. And you know something? She doesn't look like that at all today, 2 years later. And she doesn't look at all like she looked at a month or 2 months or 3 months or 4 months or five or six or 10 or 20. And what you have to conclude, if you get out of the dullness of incapacitated perception, what you notice is this form is a piece of plastic. It's in a state of becoming. And it becomes according to the energetic patterns in which we engage. If we engage in these things on the right side of the board, hostility and fear, grief, rage, anger, sadness, jealousy, revenge, then we're continuously putting into the cells that are storing that particular energy, and my offering is that every cell in your structure functions as a brain cell, functions to store information. And so we're literally changing the plastic nature of every cell and overall the whole structure of this thing we call a body-mind unit. And we're laying that on top of, you know, we can't just step in, or at least normally, I think we get to a level of power where we might be able to, but we don't just step in and make an instant change in a whole structure. Why? Well, there are 1,000 generations of that mind energy becoming flesh within each of our structures. You know, we don't have to direct its becoming, it's happening. But as we grow in awareness and choose to engage in energetic patterns, we start to direct its becoming. This side of the board, we direct it into the disease process. This side of the board, we direct it into health and wholeness and higher states of being. And if we lived on a planet where 7.5 people woke up every morning, 7.5 billion people, pardon me, woke up every morning realizing that this is who they are, how different would our creative process be? If we didn't have people playing these games, if we weren't playing these games, how different would this piece of plastic look for each of us? What would it be capable of? And as I say, when we engage in that mind energy and it lands on the cell, that mind energy, when it's of a disintegrative nature, the cell says, ouch, it informs us that the quality of our creative process is off base. But what do we do? Well, what our culture has taught most of us to do is blame somebody else for that. Have you ever said this to somebody? You made me really mad. You hurt me. You really have a problem. You ever said that to somebody? And the question I like to ask is, if they're the one with the problem, why are you the one with the pain? That doesn't make any sense. If they're the one with the problem, they'd be the one with the pain. But if you're in pain and you think somebody else has got a problem, you've got a problem. Now, we have a definition for the act of thinking or speaking as though something outside of you is causing what's happening inside of you. And that's called denial. So denial is the act of thinking or speaking as though something outside of us is causing something inside of us to happen. Now, something outside of us can cause something that's inside of us to move or intensify in its movement, but it can't cause that energy to be there. It has to be there in the first place. But when we live in this game of denial, you know, whenever I feel this way, I talk about them or somebody or anybody. What happens is that in order to pretend that my feelings aren't coming from the interaction of my mind energy and my cells, I have to hide that whole process from myself. I literally have to dissociate from that process. And I have to hallucinate, I have to generate a worldview, a perceptual construct that tells me that the problem is really out there. And of course, one of my favorite tongue-in-cheek lines, which many of you have used many times, is, if you've been through it 87 different times with 42 different people, how is it that you're the only one that was there every time? Sooner or later, we have to acknowledge that we're engaged in our own lives. But if we spend our whole lives in denial, you made me mad, you made me sad, you made me angry, you hurt me, that upset me, they disturbed me, then we have a device called a mind that continuously constructs the world we see as though that was true. And what that means is that the real cause of what we're experiencing, we have to dissociate from. And if you were involved in this work back in the early days, you remember that I used to write on the board, deny, suppress. And it totally changed the work when I was given this instruction. I mean, I had specific instructions that were given internally from Ruka that said, Michael, no, it's not suppress. It's not merely hiding something from yourself. It's locking it away and throwing away the key. Once you're in an arena where you're in denial, you made me mad, your mad is no longer yours to change. So guess what? You now have a life sentence of mad. Anybody and everybody that can trigger that into activity can seem to make you mad. Why can they make you mad? Because mad is there. And if mad is there, it's an energy. And if you pushed it down 1,000 times, there's a very intense high energy wave radiating out from you that says to all the world on an energetic level, hey world, is there anybody that knows how to make me mad? Have you ever noticed there's never a shortage of volunteers? Why is that? Because life abhors you being diseased. Life doesn't want you dead. So life has been structured, it seems, so that if you are holding to a dis-ease energy and you've dissociated from it, someone's going to show up, and that happens through the law of resonance. Someone is going to receive the energetic invitation to come to your life and do to you exactly what you never wanted to have done. And if you tell them what's wrong with them and you get rid of them and you go away and you take the geographic cure, you'll find somebody else and somebody else and somebody else. I feel so blessed the universe reserved the title of my book for me. Why is this happening to me again? Because virtually everybody in the universe has asked the question. And, you know, probably the greatest atrocity done to us as human beings down through the ages and that we've bought into is that we've had hidden from us the fact that we are by nature creators. Nobody told us that. They told us all kinds of crazy things, but they didn't tell us that through the energetic patterns we engage in, we create our own cellular health and diseases. We create everything that shows up. We literally create the way this piece of plastic called a body-mind unit unfolds and becomes either toward disease or toward health. It depends on what the predominant resonant energy is in your structure. So for people who live in this state of denial, this state where it's all everybody else's fault, they hold all of these causes within themselves, but they press those causes down, hide them from themselves, and by so doing, intensify them every time they have to press it down, and therefore send out a signal that gets even stronger and stronger and stronger. You know, imagine that I've got a 3-foot diameter spring that sits here on the floor and it stands 3 feet high. Can that spring do anything sitting there on the floor? Not at all. But what happens if I push down on it and lock it? And I push down on it and lock it. And I push down on it and lock it. What happens after years of doing that and I let the lock off? Whew, a lot of power stored in the spring. If I've been spending years and years and years telling everybody else why they're the problem in my life, I'm pushing down that energy, adding energy and information to it, and by so doing, I'm setting up a literally an attractive energy field that will resonate or pull somebody into my life to do it to me again. So when I live life that way, when that's the game that I play, the things that I most don't want to deal with are literally stored in brain cells. When I talk about building brain cells in this work, I'm not talking about building new physical structure. I'm talking about the fact that every cell in the structure is designed to store information, literally to store frequencies. So every cell can hold energetic patterns and therefore function as a brain cell. When there's certain brain cells that I don't want to deal with, things that I'm in denial about, I push those things down and hide them. I intensify them. And by so doing, I set up a high energy wave. Now, I didn't know at the time how important a piece of information this was going to be way back, and this goes back probably 35 or 36 years ago. I used to keynote at a conference called Global Science out in Colorado. And one year, a gentleman named Marcel Vogel came to the conference. Marcel was a 23-year senior scientist from IBM. He was the only non-degreed scientist that IBM ever had on their payroll. And the reason he was non-degreed was because he was self-educated and nobody could teach him anything. At the age of 11, Marcel invented chemical light. You know, you go to a football game and they've got these light sticks and you break the glass tubes inside the plastic and the chemicals mix and they light up. Well, that was Marcel's invention. He invented that at 11. His family didn't have the money. Marcel patented it himself. If your computer works, guess why? Marcel invented the magnetic coating on the plates of your hard drive that allows your hard drive to store information. That's the kind of mind that Marcel had. And what he did this particular year is he brought a thing called a Delaware camera. It was created by a man out of England named George Delaware. This camera is a little different than your average camera. Normally, you click the shutter, the aperture opens, light energy comes in, it's registered on the photographic plate, you develop it, you've got a picture. Not so with the Delaware camera. In between the aperture and the photographic plate, there's a tuning mechanism. So you can literally tune the camera, somewhat like a TV set or a radio, as to what frequencies it receives. And so what Marcel was able to do with this camera was he was able to attune it to the frequency of waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. And what Marcel was able to do was to take pictures of the high energy waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. So whatever we're holding in the way of mind energy within our structures, from our own lives or from our genes, we're literally sending out a composite of frequencies continuously. And because the universe is governed by the law of resonance, the law of resonance simply stated says this: when two energy systems are in tune or in harmony with each other, there's an interchange of energy between them when one system is amplified above the other. You probably remember from physics class in high school. You took a middle C tuning fork, you hit it on a desk, and you put it in front of a second middle C tuning fork. The second middle C tuning fork was not moving. But when you put the first energized tuning fork in front of it, the second tuning fork started to move. It's called resonance, transfer of information. So notice that this tuning fork is moving, and through resonance, that one starts to move. Resonance creates motion. You might think about let's imagine you've got a baby grand piano, and you have two of them, and you open the top of the two baby grand pianos. Now, there are hundreds and hundreds of keys in each piano. But if I go over to one of those pianos, and I hit the middle C, and I go look into the second piano, there are going to be a bunch of strings vibrating in that second piano. Guess which ones? Only the ones that are keyed to middle C are going to be moving in that second piano. So resonance creates motion. Now, in the human realm, my offering is, resonance adds another piece to the puzzle, and that is resonance creates motion toward. So, you know, I hit middle C on this piano. The other piano isn't going to get up and crawl up on top of it. It's not going to create motion toward. But in the human realm, when I set up a frequency, those who are in resonance with that frequency are going to tend to be drawn into my space. And if there's something that I have denied and dissociated from 1,000 times and it's deeply hidden away in the darkest recesses of my mind, I don't even know it's there, but having pushed it down 1,000 times, it's got a pretty powerful wave coming out of it. Now, if this person has the matching bag of garbage, if this person has the brain cells and the behaviors that match what I've denied and dissociated from, unless they are very conscious, they will tend to be directed by that energy wave. That energy wave will resonate these brain cells in them. Those brain cells will fire, constitute their, what they would call their conscious thought and behavior, and they're going to tend to do a behavior toward us. Guess what the behavior is likely going to be? Let's see if that's true. Has anybody ever gone into somebody's space totally committed to being loving, nurturing and caring, and all of a sudden found yourself functioning like a mad banshee? What happened? Well, here's my offering. You went in totally committed to being loving and nurturing and caring, but their high energy wave set something else in motion in you. It resonated your mad banshee. And when your mad banshee started to move, that took over your behavior, and there you were doing it to them again. That's how the why is this happening to me again principle occurs. And guess what? Even if you didn't do it, they're going to see you do it. Well, Michael, that doesn't make any sense. Oh, yeah, it does when you know how the mind operates, because here's what's going to happen. When they do that behavior, when they bounce off of that high energy wave in you and do that behavior, they're going to resonate those very brain cells that you've denied and dissociated from. When those brain cells start to fire, they're going to create a perceptual construct that will be projected from those brain cells, and you're going to show up in their mind. Literally, they will see a body that they call you in their mind with and made up of the threads of energy of what you denied and dissociated from. So they're going to show up in your mind with your problem. Is that you're going to see that it's their problem. It's going to be really clear to you. But then notice you've been through it 87 different times with 42 different people, and you're the only one that was there every time. This is an internal process that comes about as a result of denial and dissociation. So what happens when we deny and dissociate? This is the energetic pattern that occurs. And then when those brain cells fire, and we live in a culture, you know, psychology tends to tell us that projection is taking something that's inside of you and putting it outside of you. That's not projection. That's externalization. Projection is when I take brain cells I've denied and dissociated from, and I generate perception out of it. I generate the picture world that I see. Now, it's interesting, and of course, we've been teaching this for decades, but a couple of years ago, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago now, we came across some research that was done by the CIA. If you go to CIA.gov, you can download a book. God knows how many taxpayer dollars they spent on it. It was called The Study of Human Intelligence. And there's a chapter in it on perception. They're studying how perception works. And here's their bottom line conclusion. You can go to the CIA website and download this book free. What it says is, the mind does not record reality, the mind generates reality. This perceptual world, the world that you see, is a generated world. And as a generated world, it is a construct of your mind. And until you interrupt what's at the root of the way your mind constructs the world that you see, you will tend to be stuck in this pattern of denial, dissociation, and then projection. Now, our culture tells us that we have a pair of windows that we all get to look out of and see what's going on in the world. That is probably the biggest lie you've ever been told. You do not have a set of windows that look out into the world. It's not possible. You have an antenna. It's called the eye. It's a frequency receiving device. It receives frequencies based in light energy. Light energy enters the eye, and through the law of resonance, the information that comes in through the eye resonates brain cells. And brain cells generate perception, the world you see. You can't look out through this antenna. All the eye is, as the other senses are simply frequency receivers. They're just receivers of energy. And whatever energy you have brain cells for, whatever brain cells that resonate in you, the brain, the mind, distinguish between those two because the mind functions through every cell in the body, the mind generates this perception. And it's interesting, there's some Harvard research that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, that is, there are 10,000 measurable units of electrical activity going on within this structure. In that time frame, which is about a 25th of a second, the max amount of data that goes into building your perceptual world is 9 bits. That's it. You get to see 9 bits out of 10,000 brain cells firing, and it's been estimated that the actuality of the world perhaps contains as much as 20 trillion bits in that same time frame. So we're looking at a tiny, tiny fragment of what's actually happening in the world and a tiny fragment of what's going on within our minds. Now, when you get down to that, what you call this sort of a device is an evidential device. When you're only looking at 9 bits of data out of 10,000 brain cells firing, you're looking at evidence. There are no facts there. There is only evidence. And there's a device, or there's a function of the mind called a bias. And, you know, in electronics, if you've got a, let's say you've got a transistor, and that transistor is designed to pass a certain frequency, you have to apply a voltage to it that allows that to pass. Well, it's pretty much the same here. You have to apply a willingness to have certain evidence present itself. And so that bias that is what's contained in literally our whole generational pattern. And as a result, the only evidence we ever get to see is evidence of our own BS. And of course, that's a belief system. Anybody else have a different reality for those initials? If you have a different reality for those initials, I'll invite you to notice that's your reality. It's not mine. It's a belief system. I've had people who got, you know, upset with me for writing the initials BS on the board. And notice that they weren't upset because of my meaning, my reality, my perceptual construct for BS, belief system. They were upset and disturbed by a perceptual construct in their minds for those initials. Yeah. All upset is internal. You can't be upset unless you have an upsetting energy within yourself. And if you live in denial, they upset me, then dissociating from that upset, you will project it into your brain's image of someone else, and, you know, an endless procession of people will show up being the problem in your life. But you're the only one that was there every time. And when you understand that, these eyes don't see out there, but the world you see is generated from the firing of brain cells within you. Dr. Tim introduced a video by a gentleman, and take a look on, you know, you can go into YouTube and search for Anil Seth, A-N-I-L-S-E-T-H. And he does a beautiful presentation where he informs us that the brain doesn't see light and the brain doesn't hear sounds. No such thing happens. The brain, the perceptual system, is constantly making its best guess about what's going on out there. When you realize that's how your perceptual system works, then, and you realize that perception has a quality, you got to have a standard by which to measure the perceptions you're going to accept and the ones you aren't. There is a sign within your structure that will tell you 100% of the time when your perception is off base. And that is your perception fueled by either hostility or fear? Ever asked earlier, anybody ever accuse you of doing something you've never done or saying something you've never said? And, you know, most everybody in an audience will raise their hand, you know, kind of a laugh. Yeah, I sure have. Take a moment and think about any time in your life where somebody's done that kind of accusation and they were not correct. What state of mind were they in when they accused you of saying something you never said and doing something you never did, even though they swear they saw you do it? I guarantee it's always hostility and fear.
Yeah.
Now, probably that makes sense to you when you're looking at other people, but notice that you still have a tendency to trust your mind when it's doing hostility and fear. Hostility and fear are indicators that the mind is using corrupt data to build the world that you see. If you come from generations and generations and generations of hostility and fear-based perception, then it seems like that's the only thing possible. Is perceptions based in that. But the mind does not record reality. The mind generates reality. If your mind is generating your reality out of hostility or fear, and remember, this is reality. The perceptual output of the mind is your reality. And what's going on in the world, this 20 trillion bit world, is actuality. When you can let the actuality come in and teach you, well, what are you going to have to do to be able to do that? You're going to have to make a space for it to happen. You're going to have to collapse this projection. Guess what forgiveness does? Is forgiveness about letting other people off the hook because pain or trauma is moving in you? Forget it. Never forgive anybody for anything. And many people say, oh yeah, that's right, I have to forgive myself. Never forgive yourself for anything because you can't. It's not possible. What the Greeks taught us was to let other people off the hook. They taught us pardoning in place of forgiveness and totally bastardized the idea of forgiveness. Forgiveness is the tool with which you collapse perceptions based in hostility and fear, and you leave a clean and open space within your mind for something based in active love to come forward. And when that happens, then what enters into and what fuels the human mind is the state of being that we are designed to function out of. And this physiological device becomes a home where love is incarnated and embodied, and it fuels absolutely everything. So the key tool that's needed, if you recognize that your life has any given arenas, you know, it might be in the arena of relationships or money or business or work or employers, employees, whatever arena it's in, if you find yourself, your mind producing hostility and fear, your job, should you choose to accept it, is to weaken those frequencies of hostility and fear until they can no longer take over your perceptual system. Now, each of us has an innate tendency to perceive life in a certain way. That's because we have generational patterns. Remember we talked about there's integrative energy, there's disintegrative energy. Interesting, in the Aramaic language, The word that describes disintegrative energy is sin. It's an interesting word in Aramaic. The word sin has nothing to do with some terrible, awful thing that you've done. The word sin in Aramaic is actually an archery term. When you picked up the bow and arrow and you fired at the bullseye and you missed the bullseye, the scorekeeper yelled sin. All it means is you're off the mark. That's all it means. And if I put an energy that's off the mark, some form of hostility or fear, into a cell, I begin the degradation of that cell. Now let's go back to the Aramaic way where they informed us the wages of sin is death. Now I can remember being a kid and thinking, oh, God's going to get me for my sins. That was what I was taught. You're going to be punished for your sins. And here we live on the punishment plan. How common is that belief? What if we lived on a world planet where 7.5 billion people could not even conceive of punishment, let alone reach out in punishment? What if we had 7.5 people who simply functioned as love and punishment never entered their awareness in any way, shape, or form? How different would our world be? I'm offering a worldview that that's possible, and that's where we want to go with this work. So when they say the wages of sin is death, all they were saying is, if you put disintegrative energy on top of disintegrative energy on top of, on top of, on top of, you're going to die. Your structure isn't going to be able to carry that burden. Literally, mind energy becoming flesh, that chemistry that we call it that lands inside the cell is going to create deterioration of the cell. You get enough cells deteriorating, you get an organ system failing. You get enough organ systems failing and you die. Life can't be supported in a system that is filled with sin. And it's got no connotation of, you know, evil, bad, wrong, nasty. It's just, what quality of energy are you engaging in? And then you remember they said, the sins of the fathers will be passed, yea, unto 3 and 4 generations. This is straight out of scripture, and guess what? It's got nothing to do with religion. It's just the way the system works. It's interesting. I came across this morning some emails from a friend from several years ago, and I'd sent him some of the material on the Beatitudes and the Kabbalah's manuscript, and he passed it on to a business acquaintance. And I just read it this morning, and this fellow was Jewish, and he was putting forward some of Yeshua's ideas in Aramaic, these kinds of ideas. And this guy, this executive from a company he was working with, sent back, he says, what, you and Jew are talking about Jesus? I'm going to have to sit down and have a few shots of tequila before I read this, because our world's been brainwashed that this is about religion, and that's just another scam to keep people separated and finding somebody else at fault and not living as their true nature. What this man said is, this is what causes you to die, and you have generations of that in there. Who told you that literally, I mean, you go back 4 generations, and that's 31 lives. Who told you that you have every thought, every feeling, every reality structured within your structure of the previous 30 people in your generations? Did anybody tell you that? The thoughts, the feelings, the attitudes, the perceptual constructs of mom and dad, and mom and dad's mom and dad, and their moms? Did anybody tell you that? This book called Scripture is not about theology. Here's where it's about genetics. It's about physics. It's about physiology. It's about psychology. It's about how this energy system called life works. But the Greeks didn't want us to know that. You'll notice the Greeks, you know, they had these gods that raped their own mothers, murdered their own children. Pretty heavy-duty group of folks. So through that filter came this insane interpretation of something was just meant to help you to determine how to live your life. So if you've got generations of energies that are off the mark in there, you're in trouble. And of course, you think about 3 to 4 generations, and where did the previous fourth generation back get their thoughts, their feelings, their realities? but from the previous generation and the previous. And so what this work ultimately is inviting you to do, and I'll say that having developed this and worked with this for almost 50 years now, when people are first introduced to this, they get it on a certain level. But it isn't until people work with it for 5 to 10 years that they really grasp what it's about, what it really means. And what we're inviting each of you to do is to develop a skill unheard of in our culture. And that is the skill of being able to delve inside of your own energy system, to learn to collapse projections of untoward energies, move into and literally decode what's in the cell. Literally, that mind energy comes in, lands on a receptor site, is integrated in the cell. The skill is to pull that out of the cell and throw it away. That's forgiveness. And to be able to literally develop the skill to go down to the point where you literally are sensitive enough to the energies contained within your structure that you can go back into the generational patterns and pull the neuropeptides out of the genes that create that pattern, that create this inclination that's activated in certain ways in your life. So we're inviting you to develop a set of skills. And it doesn't happen on day one or day two or day 10 or day 20. You know, I have people like, you know, oh, I got $5 in 5 minutes. Tell me everything you know, Michael. No, that's not how it works. I use an example of that. And I say this by way of hopefully inspiring you to really take. I'm suggesting you do at least 2 worksheets a day in each assignment as they come, as we go through this intensive. And if you do, through the period of the 14 weeks, you'll integrate it into your life as a habit, and it will become yours for life. That's one of the benefits of doing this intensive this way, as opposed to people coming to Heartland for 16 days and doing it all, but then taking it back to their lives and trying to integrate it into their daily lives. It's a challenge. But ultimately, what we're inviting you to do is to develop the skills of being able to go into the deepest parts of your structure, access what's there and what doesn't belong, to literally be able to throw it away, to remove it. And what does that look like? What are we capable of? And I use an example. Michael J., my son, is a computer nerd. And when he was about 15, he decided he wanted to learn about computers. And I had a student friend in Kansas City who was a former NASA computer scientist. And he's someone that I'd worked with for several years. He'd done my work, and we just became buds over the years. And so I called Graham and I said, hey, Michael J. wants to learn about computers, and I know you've got a computer school aside from about 4 computer businesses. Can Michael come and work with you? He said, sure. And Michael J., of course, was raised at Heartland. And thank you to Fran Tyner, because Fran was this, the first 2 or 3 years that we were at Heartland, and Michael J. was, you know, I guess he was about 8 or 9, and he became Fran's tail. He went everywhere Fran went, and Fran just had this ability to do anything with his hands. So Michael learned that skill from him. And so he ended up going and living in Graham's home and doing kind of an exchange with him for room and board while he was going to school and studying computers. Actually, over a period of a couple of years, when Michael J.'s stereo system left the house, we knew he'd gone to Kansas City, and that was it. But I tell the story because there was a point where I had bought a new computer, and when I got that computer up and running, got it online, you know, this is back when you pushed the button, it went beep, 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 all these tones, and you got this crawling thing that happened. Well, it didn't work properly. So I called the company, and I don't know, I spent 2, 3, 4, 5 hours on with technical support. They couldn't get the computer working. So they said, well, pack it up and send it back to us. We'll fix it. So I packed it up, sent it back to them. 2 weeks later, I got the computer back. It's ostensibly fixed. I plug it in. Same problem. Exact same thing. So I got on the phone with the computer with tech support again, go through the whole routine. They can't get it working. So I don't bug Graham because he's a really busy guy. He's got 3 or 4 businesses. And so I picked up the phone and I called and said, Graham, I apologize for bugging you, but I got a problem. Can you help me? And so I explained what had happened. And, you know, I sent the computer back and they couldn't fix it. And, you know, what do I do? It's a brand new computer. He says, okay, well, go to a C prompt. At that point, I was a little bit ignorant of computers. I said, what's a C prompt? And I followed his directions. He said, well, put in a string of letters and hit a return. So I put in a string of letters, hit a return. Read to me what it says. And I read it to him. And he says, okay, type in this string of characters and hit a return. Read to me what it says. So I put that in, hit a return, and I read it to him. He says, okay, your computer's fixed. What? Your computer's fixed. Now, come on, Graham. I mean, I sent it back to them. We've spent hours on the phone. Michael, your computer is fixed. Guess what? My computer was fixed. Now, the company that built the system couldn't troubleshoot what Graham did literally in 3 minutes on the phone. That's called having brain cells for something. Are there challenges in your life? Are there hostilities and fears that you can't seem to overcome? Are there disorders and diseases that just don't seem resolvable? Well, as I said, 5 to 10 years of engaging. And people say, well, that's a long time. I don't know if I want to. Well, what else is there to do? There is no other path to this end result than doing your work. You know, in the ancient times, they wanted an instant fix too. Well, $5, 5 minutes. What did they say to them? You can't storm the gates. You can't do it. It takes doing your work. You have this body-mind unit. There are generations and generations and generations of untoward energies in there. And you've just got to clean it up. Now, I've spent the last half century studying how to do that, how it works, what that all means. And this is my end result. It is actually the thing that inspired me to take it to the next level. My son just turned 40. Was his birth. And when he came into the world, it was just like so awesome and delivered him, caught him with my hands. And it was just so amazing. And then I looked at the world at that time and it's like, well, if somebody doesn't do something, there isn't going to be a world for this little one to grow up in. And this is what I did. And so I invite you to be on the team and be part of the process and key into how this process of healing works, what it really means. And the core of the forgiveness process, we're not actually going to get into doing the worksheet tonight, but we're going to get into what the core of the forgiveness process is. And from there, you can tap into, and you know, you can go to our website, or pardon me, to your phone's app store, and just type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, one word, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, forgiveness. And you'll be looking at the world's, as far as I know, only forgiveness app. You can do the worksheet. There are 2 different versions of it on that, on your phone now, once you download that. And or you can go to whyagain.org, and in the upper left-hand corner of the page, it says start here, click that button. It'll walk you through literally 50 years of what it took to understand how this process of forgiveness works. And what I'm going to explain to you right now, I didn't understand until I had worked with this for about 35 years. It took that to decode from the Aramaic and come to understand all of the aspects of how this comes together, the physiology, the physics, the psychology, the genetics of it, and how it all works. But suffice to say, in its shortest form at this moment, perception is the output of your mind. It's made of 9 bits of data. If your perception is fueled by any form of hostility or fear, you have a problem because you are suffering from degraded perception. And your life will never go the way you want it to go while your perception is degraded. Underlying degraded perception is generations and generations and generations, pardon me, our generations of unresolved hostility and fear. The thing that drives this whole process, and you'll notice in your life in general, I mean, unless you're just a naturally nasty person, excuse me. If your persona is that degraded that you're a naturally nasty person, you'll notice that as long as everybody's doing what you want them to do, you're a pretty happy camper. But when someone, yourself or someone else, is not fulfilling a goal that you hold for them, that's when you go into hostility and fear, degraded perception, and untoward behavior. Why? Well, how does all that work? Well, here's what happens. Obviously, if there are 10,000 brain cells firing, and this is the most quoted piece of psychological research, and was done back in the 60s, if I remember correctly, this is the most quoted piece of research in psychological history. 9 bits of data, 10,000 brain cells fired. Now, there's other research that's come up since then that says, no, it's 13, it's 12. It doesn't matter. The point is, we get to see a little tiny fragment of what's really going on within us. And obviously, something has to determine which 9 bits of data your mind is going to use to build your perception. Something has to make that determination. What is it? The driver for that whole process is your goals. When you load a goal in the mind through resonance, everything associated with the frequency of that goal. Remember, everything is frequency. You know, I actually don't speak words. I've never spoken a word in my life, and neither of you. We call it words, but actually, I have a little flap of skin in my throat, and I know how to blow air over it so that it creates these things that we call words. But what's really happening is this air moving out causes air molecules to move. The air molecules moving cause a little drum inside of your ear to move, and that drum moving sets up an electrical frequency, and nothing is communicated by that except frequency. No light, no sound, no nothing goes in there or here. What goes in is frequency. And then that frequency causes brain cells to fire. And now your whole history, including your whole genetic history through the last 1,000 generations, is set into activity through the law of resonance. Whatever that goal resonates in you is going to be the information that is recruited by that goal to produce the perception, which includes attitudes and your behaviors. If you don't like the behavior that you're doing, you know, we hear about the alcoholic that got drunk and did crazy stuff. And the next morning when they wake up, they are so repentant. Oh, that's so terrible. I will never do that again. And they really mean they're never going to do it again. But guess what? Next time they get drunk, they'll do it again. Remember we talked about inhibitors earlier? What's the first thing that happens with alcohol? Excessive amounts of alcohol knock out inhibitors. And now all the generational patterns that were never allowed, they were always shut down, they were always inhibited, will come into play and people do crazy stuff. And much as they feel sorry the next morning and swear they're never going to do it, unless they go in and clean up these generational patterns, they're going to do it the next time the circumstance warrants it. And so goals are the driver for this process of billions of bits of information moving in the world, billions of bits moving in us, and 9 bits end up producing the world we experience, the thoughts we think, the feelings we feel, and the energy we engage in. And this process is designed to be fueled by active present love. That's the power supply that it's designed to work with. Now, does anybody have a device in your home, your office, your shop, your car, your business that works really well when you unplug it? No. Human perception is designed to be fueled by human life. It's designed to be fueled by active present love. If your perception is fueled by hostility or fear, then you're not even human. Just because one has a human form does not mean they are human. Remember holding the newborn? Go back and hold that newborn child. Notice when you hold the newborn, what serenity, what peace, what sweetness, what the presence of love is like. Then ask yourself a question. Is the newborn loving me or is the newborn love? My offering is the newborn is the active presence of love, and so are you. If the active presence of love isn't active in your physiology, then there's no human life, because it is love that is human life. Remember Yeshua said, I come to bring you life? You look at his whole body of work, and the whole thing is about how do you get rid of the hostility or fear, and how do you fuel your mind by the active presence of love? Now, it's a two-part process. One part of the process is the dissolution of the generational patterns that do not belong. That's called forgiveness. Forget about ever forgiving anybody ever again. And it always amazes me, because I've had people who have been around my work 10, 15, 20 years, and they'll still talk about how well I forgave them. Stop. Never forgive anybody for anything. If you choose to pardon someone, you know, they did something crazy, and you go, I can let that go. I'm going to let it go. I'll pardon you. I'll let you off the hook for that. That's done. But if you call that forgiveness, you won't actually do the next level, which is go inside yourself and remove and clean up the untoward energies that never belong within a human structure. So forgiveness is about the removal of what never belonged. That's half of the process. And the other half of the process is the integration of active love into every cell. To literally create a space in this form where love actively shows up in physiology. Now, the short form of the forgiveness process, and again, please use the radio show, ask questions. The short form of the forgiveness process is, the word forgive in Aramaic is shebag, and it literally translates from Aramaic to cancel. Now, what is it that I cancel? Do I cancel you? Well, that's murder. Probably not a good idea. Do I cancel myself? Well, no, that's suicide. Let's let that one go. But what in every circumstance where I have upset or discernments going on, that means there's an untoward energy moving in my physiology. If I'm going to come out of my denial, what is it that I can cancel to change that whole process? When I cancel my goal, the perception generated as a result of that goal collapses. When it collapses, I now have a clean and open space within my mind where these underlying energies can surface. Because when I cancel a goal and collapse a perception, what happens is a pathway is opened into the unconscious or the dissociated content. And what I've dissociated from, depending on my level of willingness, what I've dissociated from will start to come upward to awareness. Now, when I say awareness, it might just be awareness of the energy moving. And it might be specific memories of things that have happened. It's not necessary to go back and remember each dark, dirty, nasty thing that happened in your life. And it's not about laying on the couch and, you know, examining what happened for 30 years until you find that thing. It's about living in and as the active presence of love, making a commitment to that. And as you walk through life, the next piece of work you're ready to do, resonance will bring somebody to you that will resonate what you need to deal with. If you keep it hidden, then you'll only get this surface projection and you'll think it's somebody else. When you cancel the goal, you collapse that perception. It took me 35 years to learn this piece of information. And I understand why the Greeks turned it into pardoning, letting other people off the hook. I understand it fully, because until you've got all these pieces, you know the physics, you know the physiology, you know the high energy, until you put all those pieces together, canceling a perfectly good goal does not make any sense at all. Gee, I just want that person to cherish me. And they're raging at me. Why would I cancel my need to be cherished? Because I'm in terror. Oh, so my physiology is producing terror because I want to be cherished. Oh, so Michael, what you're saying is what you now understand about me is that in my file on being cherished, there's terror. Oh, okay, I see. So if I cancel my goal for them to cherish me, my projection on them collapses, and it opens a pathway into all this terror that's stored within my brain cell structure, and maybe the terror that's stored from 30 generations ago that needs to be unwound. Oh, now I'm starting to see what forgiveness is as I cancel the goal. Now, I have a 9-bit processor. So we're going to call it for the sake of whatever term we're going to use. If I've got something that's been going on in my bloodline for 25 or 200 generations, and I can process 9 bits at a time, what chance do I have? It's impossible. I mean, it's silly to even try. Fortunately, this man Yeshua understood another major piece of information. And that was that at creation, there was a power put in us that in Aramaic was called Ruka Dekudsha. The Greeks translated these words as the Holy Spirit. It's nothing about a disembodied spirit being in the term Ruka Dekudsha in Aramaic. In Aramaic, those terms speak of a feminine elemental force in us that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. So when I become willing enough, I will literally, I mean, one of my best examples for, I don't know, 35 years or more. If you were in my workshop 35 years, or, well, 15 years ago, these weren't the words at the top of the board. This word was suppressed. Literally, as I'm sitting and I'm making some changes to the worksheet, the one you see on the website now or in the app is probably at least version 3020. I was sitting doing some work with it, and literally I'm told inside my head, Michael, it's not suppression. That's not clear enough. It's dissociation. What do you mean dissociation? It's not just that you've hidden it away. It's that it's no longer yours. It's gone. You can't change it. When you understand that denial, thinking or speaking as though something outside of you is the cause of this that's in you, then you have to believe that, hide the real process that's happening inside of you. This genius, Yeshua, genius. I mean, how did he come up with this? I don't know. But here's what he showed us. Cancel the goal. Collapse of perception. Perception drops in on its root. You've now got access to the hidden part of your mind. Bring it forward in the presence of love. And then there's a super processor that is available to you. In Aramaic, it was called Ruka Dekudsha. She, a feminine elemental force in us, that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. So at the point where I cancel the goal and collapse, I may open so much that I'm so overwhelmed. This is part of the whole flood idea. You know, I'm so overwhelmed. There's just so much to move. How do I do it? I connect with Ruka. What is Ruka? In the original Aramaic, they never said anything about God sending out his spirit. What it says is the Creator sent out his breath. We have access to this phenomenal super processor called Ruka Dekudsha. She will, if you invite her to, undo the effects of your errors and teach you the truth. Now, if you've still got a use for one in your lives, well, I just want to keep this little bit of hostility back here so I don't need it to protect myself, then she's not going to touch your hostility. It's yours. Hang out with it all you need, all you want. But when you're really to surrender, when you're ready to really let it all go, she will process you right down to your genetic toast.